What is regenerative business? How can we create a business mindset that addresses social, economic, and environmental issues? Esha Shabra has written for national and international publications over the last 15 years, focusing on global development, the environment, and the intersection of business and impact. Her work has been featured in The New York Times, The Economist, The Guardian, and other publications. She is the author of Working to Restore, Harnessing the Power of Business to Heal the Earth. Esha Shabra, welcome to One Planet Podcast and The Creative Process.
Nice to be here.
So you've been in this eco-journalism world for a long time. We're here to discuss your book, Working to Restore, Harnessing the Power of Regenerative Business to Heal the World. What is regenerative business and how do we see through the greenwashing manipulation of the certification process and carbon credits that go on to ensure that there is true impact and sustainability hardwired into corporations and businesses?
It's a big question that you've asked. I wish there was a simple answer. There's a lot of greenwashing that's going on these days. It is great marketing. And that was the reason why I wrote this book. I had spent 15 years writing about mission-driven companies. And in the last 7, 8 years, it really had been about environmental issues. And so I had started to see the patterns. You can start to tell the companies that are genuinely doing it versus the companies that are just talking about it. And these are companies that are hesitant to talk about things. So that was one indicator, a company that would send out a press release about their goals and what they anticipated to do in the next 5 to 10 years was very different from companies who had said, this is what we've achieved, have a look at this project or have a look at this supply chain. But it's very hard for the consumer, to be honest, today to discern. Obviously, there are some red flags where you use broad language of this is natural or this is better, or when there's language like that that cannot be substantiated in any way, that is the first red flag, perhaps. But also there's carbon credits. Carbon credits is a mixed bag at the moment. There's some really good projects out there where people are genuinely trying to figure out a model. And then there's some projects which we've seen, they haven't lasted. So it's very hard for the consumer. But for me as a journalist, that was the intention with this book. Here's a few case studies of companies that are truly doing it. Look at their business models, explore who they are as entities, and see where that takes you. If you're a consumer, you can support it through a purchase. If you're a young person wanting to get into business, maybe that's a company you want to work for or learn from. But that's really the essence of this book. And the last part of that question was also about regenerative. So regenerative started coming into the lexicon, the term, in 2017, 2018. And that was right when I was beginning to write this book. And it came from the world of agriculture. So regenerative agriculture was really where we were hearing this. And to regenerate means to bring life into something. To sustain means to keep the status quo. And regenerative looks at things from a very holistic lens. If you're going to run a regenerative farm, it's all the different components of the farm and the ecosystem ideally come within the ecosystem. You're not buying stuff from the market. You're creating your own compost, your own fertilizers, pesticides. It's that same mindset applied to business. How do we create an ecosystem that is very healthy and self-sustaining? That's why most of the companies that are profiled in the book, they may be in a chapter that's about soil or in a chapter that's about waste. But they do so many more things if you dig into them. Then looking at who they're employing, where the financing is coming from, then looking at how they're choosing to run the company, the leadership at the top, and supply chains. So it's really multi-layered approach. And that is the approach to regenerative. It was like one part of your business to the side. And even in sustainability, it's not just one aspect of the company. It's really the whole thing that we're looking at.
Yeah. And so you touched on all those aspects. You do start with soil, and I'd like to go into that, but you consider waste, supply chains, workforce, bringing women to the forefront, because we all know that they're the first educators. They sustain life in the home front and the workplace and travel and health and energy and finance. But going back to soil, because regenerative agriculture is so important, not just because a lot of people don't realize the health benefits, it's so linked to human health. And also, if we continue this industrialized model, we may not have the water to grow the crops that we need because the soil is dead and it requires more water to farm industrially.
Soil is a really interesting topic. It's not something that you typically want to discuss on front page headlines. We can look at it from the environmental lens, and I think we understand at this point that if you have richer soils, you have more resilient crops, and therefore you have a healthier farm. in the long run, financially and environmentally. But I think it's actually interesting that it's the financial component. When I talk to a lot of these folks in agriculture, whether it's farmers or farm-based brands, they all have said that business-wise, it makes sense. In fact, I did a piece recently for one of the news outlets that looked at cattle ranchers across the U.S., and many of them transitioned to regenerative practices, not entirely because of the environmental benefits, but because for the bottom line also, it was much better for them. Because if you think about it, if you are working off of soils that are depleted, it's going to require more water. That's an irrigation issue. But also, you're going to be more prone to all kinds of crop-related issues. It could be runoff during a storm. It could be weakened soils that result in weakened plants, so your crop is not as profitable. So there's different aspects to soil that allow you to create a healthier business. I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface on how soil health correlates to crop health. There's an organization in the U.S. called Mad Ag, which is now doing some research on also the nutrition levels in the food. When I was doing the book research, I was trying to find studies that look at how richer soils can result in more nutrient-dense foods, but there needs to be more research done on that front. So now there's an organization that's also looking at that, is that if you eat foods that are from richer soils, are they truly more nutrient-dense? And that is very important to the human population, because that's become a growing topic of discussion, is that even the fruits and vegetables we're eating, do they have the kind of nutrient density that they used to have 50 years ago? Perhaps not. And there's a variety of organizations working on that research, which I think is really fascinating. So the soil equation, it's important for carbon sequestration. It's important for the environmental story. It's important for farmers from an environmental lens, but it's also very important from a business lens, which ultimately is what encourages people to make some of these transitions. If you go to a farmer who's got thousands and tens of thousands of acres and say, do this because we think it's better for the planet, he's going to think twice. It has to also work for their bottom line.
Yes, but the human health benefits, or even if you're thinking about the animals feeding on what's coming out of the earth, it's industrialized farming. If we don't have a healthy soil, we're getting cancers and all those diseases caused by inflammation. You know, it's interesting to think about it. The ecoacoustics tell us that more than 50% of the planet's species live in the earth below our feet. And so we're killing them off in the process of this industrialized farming.
Absolutely. And even today, if you look at U.S. agriculture, it's only about 1% that's organic. And that's really crazy. We've been working at this for 40, 50 years, and we're still only at that percentage. And they identified one specific issue, which was that you can grow organic crops, you can grow organic grains, but then where do you take it for processing? And there wasn't a hub to do that. And they built a hub there to take it for processing, to get it to the market. So there's also a lot of different issues at play here where we have to create those links. We have to create that infrastructure again that allows for these kinds of businesses to flourish. And I love this story of Grain Place Foods. I mean, there's an example of people who've been doing it much before this was a trend. If you look at the biodynamic movement, and I know people have very strong opinions about biodynamic, but this is something that's been practiced for many decades. It's not a new concept in any way, but they've not been able to create scale. And so Grain Place Foods was an interesting example, because not only were they doing it on their farm, but they were also creating an ecosystem for other farmers to do it by creating a processing unit. Because the other example in the soil chapter, which looks at California Safe Soil up in Northern California, how they were using leftover produce that was unwanted for a variety of reasons and turning it into fertilizer, they were very specific that we need to create a product that can go into the current farming system. If we ask a farmer to transition away and do this in a manner that he's not been doing, it's not going to work. So they made a product that goes into the drip lines and that's suitable for farmers today. That's how you're going to get adoption. It's very hard to change some of these things, whether you're looking at food or you're looking at manufacturing and apparel and things like that. These supply chains are huge and complex and global. And so whenever you're introducing something new, it's really important that it works for all the parties at play. You can't ask people to deviate too much for cost reasons, for behavioral reasons, for many reasons.
Yeah, really a whole ecosystem. And as you discussed then, the circular economy and how regenerative business prioritize repurposing waste to minimize environmental impact. Can you just share some of those examples of companies that have adopted the circular economy?
Circular economy is, I think, a really interesting space because reality is that these waste streams are an opportunity. They're a real opportunity for these companies to rethink how they can build a product out of it. So I love the story of Toast Ale from the UK, which is not in fashion, which is what you normally think of with circular economy. But Toast Ale is this company that was started by a food activist and by a social entrepreneur, two folks. And they really felt there's this real need to create a product with this waste. So in the UK, a lot of people love to grab a ready-to-eat sandwich that you can get at a Pret or one of these kind of corner sandwich shops. And the factories that were making the sandwiches, they had to get rid of the end slices on the loaves because nobody wants those kind of fat slices at the end. And you would think that's nothing. It's two pieces of bread, right? But then you multiply that times thousands of loaves and all of a sudden you have this huge waste. And Toast said, let's make beer out of it. Making beer out of bread is not, again, a new concept, but we had deviated from that. And so they put this whole model together where they're making beer out of leftover bread. And what I love about their company is, one, not only are they using a waste stream, but two, they're trying to make this concept of regenerative interesting and fun and engaging a new audience, because it can feel a bit preachy and didactic at times. And they were like, beer is something that everybody loves and can agree on. So now they're in cafes, they're in pubs, they're in, you know, grocery stores across the UK. And they've also decided to put a percentage of their proceeds, the majority of their profits, into food waste organizations. So the cycle continues. It continues even on the profit side. It's not even just the product itself, but it's the mindset that, okay, can we take the profits of this company and then nurture more food waste organizations and more food waste programs, which I thought was really lovely. The other examples are, how do we recycle our apparel much better? There's a company called Vivo Barefoot, which was one of the first to look at how to use algae bloom into the sole that goes into a shoe. And this was a pretty crazy idea when it first came onto the market. But algae blooms are something that are in excess in nature and unneeded. And so there's a company in the US that's been looking at how to transform that material into something that is usable. And the footwear industry is now adopting it. Now there's countless companies using it. But I thought it was interesting that Vivo started using this years ago before it was a trend. And that is also circularity. It's using these waste streams and finding new purposes for them. And therefore, they're using less polyester, less plastics. Of course, there's also the apparel industry and recycling, because there's chemical recycling, there's mechanical recycling. But I think we're making progress on that front as well. There's so many companies now working on this issue since I've written the book and since it's come out. So that's also inspiring to see. It's not an easy problem to solve overnight. Part of the problem that is fundamental is that we finally realized that we're not actually recycling our stuff. I don't think the average person knew that. And it was really when this story went viral on different news platforms that, look, like 5-6% of what we throw in the recycle bin is actually ending up in a recycling unit. And the wildest part of it that most people don't realize is that a lot of it's being put on a ship and then being sent to Asia. And then when China said, no, we're not going to take any more of your trash to recycle, the US was in a real predicament where they said, what are we going to do with all this? We got to figure it out. And I think sometimes those market barriers also then push you to innovate, because then you have to figure out a solution. But yeah, the fact that recycling in itself is really complex and I would say quite broken still, that is also another incentive to try to figure out more circular business models.
And then again, that could be a whole other full conversation when we talk about accountancy and carbon, when we're outsourcing our manufacturing and our recycling to other countries, and then we're blaming them for their contributions to carbon in the atmosphere, but we're not taking into account our role in consuming their products or outsourcing our rubbish to them. And then just, you know, going beyond the soles of shoes, as we know, more than 8.3 billion metric tons of plastic have been produced in the last 75 years, ending up in landfills, and just a tiny percent is recycled into new products. But it's exciting to hear about recent nature-based innovations, which have emerged as promising solutions to plastic pollution. Things like biodegradable filters laced with plant tannins that trap micro and nanoplastics or cellulose nanofiber filters made from wood pulp that capture polystyrene microparticles and biofilms whose chemical properties collect microplastics for later upcycling. And, you know, researchers are also studying how enzymes with wax moth caterpillar saliva break down polyethylene. I guess it's a common plastic used in packaging. So these are all positives. What are your thoughts on plastics?
So in addition to being a journalist and a writer, at the end of 2019, I started a tea company. It's called Alea Tea, and we do loose leaf tea, and we do organic tea. But the packaging was a real headache. We didn't want to do glass because it's too difficult to ship. Aluminum has its own challenges. And the other option is plastic stand-up pouches, and you can get a lot of them that are made out of recycled plastics. But we decided to go down the compostable route. Now, even the supply chain of compostables is also very complex. And there's good compostables and there's some not so good. And it was a real experience to see what it's like for businesses when they're trying to figure out these solutions. You start to empathize and you really start to understand that this is not easy stuff to figure out. Because yes, the materials can exist out there. And yes, there's innovations happening with seaweed and mushrooms and all these other things that you mentioned. But one, does it work for a business financially? Because they are still expensive. And when you're looking at per unit costs for packaging and they multiply that by tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands and millions of units, it's expensive. The other thing is also then, how do we ensure that it's actually going to get into the waste disposal systems that you want it into? We can give you a compostable pouch, but if you put it in the recycling container, that's not ideal either. That's contaminating a different supply chain or a different waste system. And then there's also this question of how does a business do this at scale when you have different supply chain partners? So we are a relatively small company. We were starting out with this intention. That's fantastic. But for larger companies that have existing supply chains and they have to now introduce this new material, they have to get their supplier on board and willing to use the material. And then it has to sit possibly on a ship for 6 months, maybe, depending on how long it takes. In COVID, it was taking forever to get cargo containers emptied. Will it survive that journey? And there were companies that tried it, right? They tried to remove, for example, the plastic sleeves that clothes come in, and they tried some of the more compostable, biodegradable options, and they didn't survive. They didn't survive the journey. One of the inherent things with these materials is actually that they don't have a long shelf life. So if you're a company and you buy 2-3 years worth of product in advance, which is what sometimes companies are doing because it's very high MOQs, it can't sit for that long. It'll start to get crinkly. It'll start to lose its structure. So these are very complex problems to solve. I think the innovations are exciting. I do think the stuff that's happening in seaweed particularly is very interesting. But again, we have to look at it closely and see, is that a win for everybody? Or are we introducing possibly some new complexities in the marine ecosystems that we're harvesting and cultivating all this stuff in? So I think it's exciting. Look, I think if you want to get into a business that's probably going to grow, The packaging business is an interesting business to be in right now because there's a lot of demand and there's a lot of interest. There's not one solution that's perfect at all. And I think that the real answer will be a variety of these solutions. I don't think it'll be one of them. But do we need to move away from single-use plastic? Absolutely. Yes, I don't see the need for it. How do we cut down on that? For sure. Because again, we could talk about this for 40 minutes, but also paper is recycled much better than plastics. So yes, paper has its cons. You're dealing with the timber industry. But at the same time, the recycling rate on paper is better than plastic. So you have to look at the pros and cons of every single one of these and then see what works for your business and for your situation.
So I noticed your company, Alea Tea, is based in India and it's a woman-owned business. And based on your extensive travels in India and considering the country's rapid population growth, what additional steps do you believe businesses can take to enhance their regenerative practices while addressing the needs of a larger population?
Where do we begin? India has a real challenge ahead. It has a massive population that needs to be employed. That said, there's a lot of opportunities now in India. I was just there last month And I think it's really interesting how, yes, people are still leaving India and migrating outside of India, but there's so much more opportunity that there's actually people now moving back to India. People in my generation, their families did leave in the 80s or 90s and now looking at going back because there's so much innovation. I actually am very inspired by India. There are so many companies these days that are looking at materials. That is a huge opportunity in India to help India transition away from some of these problematic materials into more natural materials, into more eco-friendly materials. But on the people front, it's a complex question to answer. So I'll give you one example. This was a company, it's not in the book, but I discovered it years ago, I think around 2010 when I was in India doing reporting. And it's called Jaipur Rugs. It's a very well-known now case study. I think there's been like business schools that have done case studies on it. But there was a gentleman who decided that he was really interested in the rug kind of world. And he started spending time with weavers in Rajasthan. And these were weavers who lived in villages and would weave 6 hours a day and then also do other work. But they had very poor links to the market, so they couldn't get their products to the market or they would end up selling them for very low prices. And he built this robust brand called Jaipur Rugs. Now it's thousands in their network just in Rajasthan. And now they're in Gujarat, they're in other states in India as well. And he created employment and job opportunities for people at the rural level, which I think goes back to that Gandhi philosophy of how do we keep people where they are in their villages and create opportunities for them where they do get paid well. They are given a voice. They are treated very well. And Jaipur Rug tries to do all of that. I'm sure they're not perfect, but they try to do a lot of that. I think we need more business models like that because the reality is not everybody can go to the city and live in the city and work in the city. And the city has its own issues. I spent a lot of time also reporting on agriculture in the hills north of Delhi. So you have the two states, Uttarakhand and Himachal, and you see it firsthand. You go and you visit these farms, they're small farms, they're not big. And it's all women. They're all women working the farms because the men have left for the cities. And when I would talk to them, when I would ask them about their lives and their quality of life, they said, it's hard. We don't want our sons to leave for the cities. We wish that there was more opportunity for them in these rural communities. And so that is why actually I think agriculture is an interesting component in this. The demand for more food, more crops, more byproducts of these crops is growing as the population is growing. And so we need to find ways to create business opportunities for some of these small farms. There's really just a lack of market links. They don't have the ability sometimes to get their products to where they need to be able to sell them and create opportunities at the rural level. So I think India also has a lot of opportunity to create businesses like Jaipur Rugs that have a strong rural base, but are profitable, viable businesses and allow you to work from those communities instead of always migrating to the cities. There's so many more I could rattle off, but that's some of the thoughts that I can say to India specifically.
Yes, I'm not sure if you'd written about him. Thomas Krauser has this project Restore, which is like a kind of Google Maps for regenerative agriculture and restoration projects around the world. There's a lot of different projects that sort of like creates a marketplace for these small regenerative farmers that aren't doing it on that, say, more industrial scale. But yeah, it's about bringing it to market. You mentioned cities. There's a lot of efficiencies in cities and we're living in the center of the city. It's this decade of transformation. We hear a lot about, you know, smart cities, smart buildings, but people in cities, we have very little idea of where our future is going when we think about the rapid transition and planning that needs to take place, transport and education and managing our natural resources and adapting cities to be future ready.
Yeah, I live north of a city that I would not say is doing very well on that front, which is Los Angeles. We've always had a terrible transportation system, but there's certainly cities that I feel are doing this better, and they have thought through urban planning, they've thought through infrastructure, they've thought through waste. I think these are really quality of life issues. People want to live in environments where they can flourish. And if you're living in a city where you're spending hours and hours in traffic and pollution, it chips away at you. And speaking of India, it was interesting because I was in Mumbai after quite a few years. I think last time I was there was 2017. And it was just fascinating to see the city growing so rapidly. I mean, there's so much construction happening. But at the same time, it's really affecting the quality of life for some people that are commuting on those roads every single day. I mean, Mumbai's always been famous for traffic, but there's just construction after construction and rubble that's not being picked up even after the construction is done. And sometimes you do think that, how can we do this in a more efficient manner? How can we do this in a manner that is better for the environment, but also for the people that are affected in the process? I don't write about urban planning in the book, but again, it takes me back to this idea of, is the answer always migration to a city? Maybe not. In my personal life, I've tried to shift away from the city as much as I can. I don't live in the center of LA. I live north of LA. And that's a conscious decision because I feel like my quality of life is better. There's more greenery. There's more places that I can go for a walk. There's fresher air. It's cleaner. It's easier. There's less traffic. So I do think about these issues, and I do think that cities are a really complex thing to address in today's world.
I think on that note of being in nature or not being in cities, I think that you talk about the circular economy, and we know the mental health that comes with being around nature. And I think that because nature is circular by design, some part of it must be because being in a system that doesn't have so much waste, like waste exhausts us, right? It contaminates us, this sense of waste. And then being closer to nature is something that we can just observe the natural harmonies, and somehow it reflects in our well-being.
It's so interesting that you said that, because I've had this conversation now with so many people in the last month or two, where we've been reflecting on, you look at nature, the way it's designed, there is very little waste. And that waste often has a purpose if there is waste. And yet as humans, we tend to create lots of waste and we don't have a circular design. As there is so much to learn from nature. And I think we are at a point, oftentimes it can get quite frustrating when you just hear about problem after problem in the world, right? And as a journalist, I'd always taken this approach of focusing on solutions ever since I started my career. And I am inspired by some of these solutions that I'm beginning to see in different industries, because I think we are at an interesting point in time where people are very much so aware of these issues and they are trying to figure out solutions. The fundamental problem here, though, from what I saw and from what I reported, is that we have a challenge, which is that the nature of business has been focused on growth, which is opposite to this idea of circularity. Can you do growth and can you do circularity at the same time? I don't know if we've proven that yet, because a lot of the larger corporations are built on a model where they have to do this sort of trajectory of growth. It's always about maximizing profit. And that is inherently their model. That is what they are designed for. So can we encourage them to think about systems that are not going to be about the linear growth and instead about a circular model? For medium-sized businesses, especially companies that are privately owned, yes, you can do these things and at quite significant scale. But can Fortune 500 companies do all of this and still be responsible to those who have invested in them and get them the returns they need? I haven't seen a model that's been successful yet. Maybe it will be down the road. So in the book, for example, I focus only on small to medium-sized businesses. Most of them are medium-sized businesses. And I really loved what Sebastian Kopp of Veja said when I was in Brazil looking at the supply chain of their shoes. He said, we don't need to be the next Nike and Adidas. We need dozens more Vejas in the world. And I heard that from so many of the entrepreneurs in the book later, that when I was talking to them, Toast Ale was interested in just open sourcing their idea and their formula and saying, go replicate it elsewhere in the world. That allows for that kind of business model to flourish that is based on circularity. But the current model for a lot of these larger corporate entities doesn't have that embedded in it.
Yes, it is a very hopeful book, but actually showing these real world examples. And I think that the smaller and medium sized employee owned businesses are a bit more doable. That's a way that you can actually benefit the company and also benefit the workers. And I think that that's a way forward. If that could be further scaled up, all the better. But you talk about journalism. And of course, among younger generations, journalistic integrity is being challenged. And so I think connecting students with professionals, we can empower the next generation and improve trust and engagement with journalism, ensuring it remains a robust pillar of democracy. I'm wondering what your reflections are as journalism as a business, journalism in a post-truth world with the spread of misinformation, erosion of trust in institutions. What measures can be taken to foster a robust and ethical fourth estate?
Yeah, journalism is in a real pickle at the moment, I would say. Speaking of business models, that is really fundamentally one of the challenges in journalism. There's a struggle to build a financially viable business model that's always been dependent on advertising. But now that the advertising has become so scattered, whether it's print, it's digital, it's social, it's everywhere, it's become very hard for media entities to monetize that and turn it into a viable business model. And that has reflected in the quality of the journalism and the experience that a lot of young journalists have, which is that it's a very hard industry to make a living that you can grow with. There's been so many layoffs, as we've seen in the last year. The rates for some journalists have really dropped. And so it's a difficult place to be in. I do believe that there are some platforms that are succeeding, that are trying to challenge not only the business model, but also the storytelling side of it, which is moving away from here's the disaster of the day, here's the terrible news that happened today, to also highlighting some of these more interesting stories. So a few examples, I would look up the TED Talk by Angus Harvey. He's been talking about how we can create different platforms for not just positive news, but more hopeful news. There's also different smaller platforms that have succeeded, which is out of Portland, Oregon, which is a lovely website that's highlighting a lot of these solutions. I think there really are smaller projects that are doing well, but there hasn't been one massive media platform that's figured this out. Chris Anderson, who started TED, this was also one of his missions. And I think because I just come back from TED about a week ago and had the opportunity to speak with Chris, like that is the intention of TED when they started, was to highlight some of these interesting ideas and put them out there on a global scale. And they shared all their videos for free around 2006, I think it was, when they went online. And since then, there's been thousands of TEDx events around the world. I think there's now different ways to share this news rather than just the traditional media model. And people are beginning to explore that. Is you may not find this information in your traditional media outlets. So you may be finding it on YouTube or social media or a TED-like platform. And these are all new opportunities to redefine storytelling. There's an organization called the Solutions Journalism Network in the US, and David Bornstein, who was one of the co-founders, and Tina alongside him, they've been very kind mentors to me in my career. And they've done a fabulous job of trying to take this idea of solutions-oriented journalism to mainstream media houses in the US and do trainings for the newsrooms and for the editors and see how they can incorporate it into their reporting. But I still think there's a lot more scope here to do more interesting storytelling. I'm not also sure that people want to watch more and more climate docs that are just weigh you down by the 1.5 hour that you've watched them because you just feel like, oh gosh, now what? I think people are ready for a new type of storytelling that does genuinely talk about things from a solutions lens. And it's not to put things up on a pedestal. Even with this book, I'm very clear that these companies are not perfect. They have their flaws. Some may not succeed. Some may shut down. But the fact that we're even having this conversation and we're willing to read a book about this and a publisher is willing to back it, I think that's a great step in the right direction.
Yes, storytelling is in our DNA. It's how we learn. And I think it's not by being heavy on problems and light on solutions, but really providing, like you're sharing, tangible ideas that inspire action and bring about real change.
Yeah, we need shareable solutions that even if the business isn't have a long-term sustainability, others may learn from that and build upon that. And we're all educating ourselves in different ways. What are your reflections on the future of education and then the future of work, considering all the rapid advancements in AI and technology and the changing needs of society?
Yeah, this year's TED was all about AI. It was fun to listen to countless talks about AI. You know, it's interesting. I think we're becoming comfortable with AI. I remember last year, all the discourse around AI was quite frightening. I think now we're realizing that there are positive implications of AI too. Yes, there's definitely a lot of concern still that we need to figure out. But the future of education, it's interesting because I've been having this conversation with, like, you know, family members, my niece, and with other friends who have college age children. And I think the cost of education in America for 4-year colleges has become such a burden for many families and for many students. And that is not ideal. And that is not, I would say, fair. So many students are going to community colleges and then transferring to, like, I'm in California, a UC school or to another state school. And we're trying to figure out now, what is the future of higher ed in particular? There's so much information on the internet, and you can educate yourself with just endless info. It doesn't even have to be just one course. You can learn about different job opportunities, career paths, things that I didn't have access to when I was a college student as abundantly. So I think that's really hopeful. If I was a young person today, would I be so fixated on going to a 4-year university and doing it the traditional route? Maybe not. You know, get out there, learn things, try things. And I think that is the best learning. And you can learn really fast. You don't have to go down that 6 to 8 year model, however long you decide to go with your graduate, you know, studies. I think all of that is actually really exciting and interesting. And when we talk about countries like India, where there's a huge audience of people who may not have access to these resources, right? Like, if they may not be able to go to private institutions that cost a fortune, you can do so much with what is available now on your phone and online. I'm inspired by it in some ways. I think we have started to democratize education in that way. The number of podcasts you can listen to, the things that you can educate yourself on. During the pandemic, I started listening to medical podcasts, which is not my world at all, but I was very interested. And there were some really great ones I discovered, and I learned so much about the human body. While it can feel at times overwhelming that the educational system, especially in the US, is struggling, it's becoming expensive, there's a lack of equity, lack of equal opportunity, there's also a lot of resources out there that I think are exciting.
Yes, right now we're all learning as we go along and, you know, balancing the opportunities and challenges. But I do want to ask you about those teachers who were important to you. Tell us about those mentors who maybe helped you find your vision and path.
Yeah, I mean, teachers are so, I feel like they're just really not given the credit that they need to be. It just breaks my heart, especially in the US, when you hear about teacher salaries and how little they're paid, and there are societies in Europe that pay them much more and value them much more, but they really are so important. And it's not necessarily always what they teach you in the classroom. It's also the way that they nurture you. They pay attention to you. They give you guidance in life. They give you career advice. They give you life advice. And yes, there's been mentors, I would say, in every aspect of my journey. I went to a small high school. I had some really incredible English teachers. They became lifelong friends in some ways. They have been a part of my story. They were the first ones to nudge me along. I was not a great writer when I was in high school. When I went to college, that I had a professor again who was in the English department, who told me that you should consider a life in storytelling or writing or something to do with communications. And if I didn't have that professor, I don't know if I would be on this path. It was really his encouragement that pushed me along. Then I had another professor in college who was a journalist in D.C. at the time. I went to school in Washington, D.C. And he encouraged me, and he said, yeah, you have a knack for this. Like, you should pursue journalism. And then I met David Bornstein when I graduated from master's program. And he was building this incredible solutions-led program in the U.S. for journalism. And he nudged me. And I worked with him on the website called Dowser.org. And he was creating this blog that was about solutions. There's been so many people along the way who have encouraged me in my career, and they're so important. I think one thing I wish that somebody has said to me when I was in college was nurture that network, and not in a transactional kind of way, but nurture those people that want to encourage you, that want to support you, and build out that sort of community of people that you can rely on as your career evolves.
I'm wondering, because I just had a conversation with Daniel Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence and the whole series of books. And I have to ask, would you advise students to enter journalism? And he said, no. I'm not trying to be negative, but we're just talking about viability. So maybe there's evolution in the process of taking place in journalism now.
I think in a way, the traditional journalism, as beautiful and as needed as it is to have a third party view on something where it's completely not biased. The reality is you can be a storyteller in today's world in so many ways. There are social media accounts that have huge audiences that are talking about these topics and about solutions, about climate, about positive news, about all these things. So you don't have to go down that old-fashioned model. But also, I didn't go to journalism school. You know, the advice that I got, interestingly enough, from my advisors was don't go to journalism school, go in the field. And that's what I did. I got a fellowship and that allowed me to go do reporting on public health when I was very young. I was in my early 20s and I started seeing these issues firsthand and I started realizing these are stories that should be on the front pages or at least being told somewhere. And they're not. Instead, we're focused on the same sort of political circus that we write about daily. And that's when I started freelancing these stories. And I was lucky that I was early on in my career. Their editors were receptive. This was before I think everybody was getting 50,000 emails every day. So they actually read messages. And I was really fortunate that I found some editors that were willing to share these stories. But yeah, do you need to follow that traditional path? I don't think so anymore.
Exactly. We're all finding we need to embrace that sense of agency. As you think about the future education, the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I'm inspired by a lot of young people, a lot of people who are in their early 20s. They're very interested in these topics. They are actually really thinking about the environment. They love thrifting, for example, because not only is it trendy and cool and affordable, but it's also really good for the environment. I hope that they continue to fight for what is right and needed in today's world, is that we do create more equitable models, whether it's in business or elsewhere, and that we do have some kind of respect for the planet, because the reality is, if we don't, we're the ones that are going to suffer at the end of the day. It's only going to become harder for us, whether it's getting food to eat, whether it's having an environment that's comfortable and hospitable, whether it's having the supply chains we need for all the products in the world. It's not just food. Agriculture, I think, is just not given the attention that I think it deserves in many ways, because it's not just responsible for food. It's also responsible for the clothing you wear. It's also responsible for some of the medicines you eat. It's also responsible for so many different things that we use in our daily lives. So I hope that future generations, they really do look after the soils. And I hope we can create a model for them where they do want to return to some of these more unwanted careers, perhaps things like farming, things like agriculture. I hope that there is a business model and a path forward. And I hope they're the trailblazers that sort of make it happen. And I see that happening around the world. When you look at regenerative agriculture in particular, for second generation farmers, or it could be third or fourth generation even, but when they see how their fathers and their grandfathers and their families have done it for eons, and they are now realizing they can't keep doing it in the same way. So they're coming up with innovations at the farm level, or they're diversifying their income, they're diversifying their crops, they're finding different ways that they can introduce more income streams for their families. We need to encourage that. We need to create policies that also allow for some of this stuff to, you know, flourish. But I think policy is another part of this. There's so much opportunity. Yes, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the world. But don't get bogged down by it. Whatever path you choose, whether if you're in ag, help create the new business model for farmers. If you're in CPG, create products that really are regenerative to their core. There's a lot of opportunity. It really can be done, and it requires all of us to play a part in it. Otherwise, it's hard for the very few that try to go up that hill.
Indeed, it's not something that should be relegated to a small proportion of the population. We can really be a part of this regenerative agricultural revolution. Thank you, Esha Shabara, for providing a solutions-based lens for confronting the challenges of our time, being dedicated to working with progressive companies to encourage regenerative business in emerging industries, and helping shine a light on these real solutions for the climate crisis. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you, Mia. Well, thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Tavisha Yernani with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Tavisha Yernani. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. additional production support by Katie Foster. Music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved with One Planet Podcast and be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.